The following content has been provided by New St. Andrews College in Moscow, Idaho. For more information, visit us online at www.nsa.edu.
All right, Chapter 6, Westminster Confession of Faith, of the Fall of Man, of Sin, and of the Punishment Thereof. Paragraph 1. Our first parents, being seduced by the subtlety and temptation of Satan, sinned in eating the forbidden fruit. This their sin God was pleased, according to his wise and holy counsel, to permit, having purpose to order it to his own glory. All right, so the confession here says that our first parents were seduced by the subtlety of Satan. Although Genesis does not mention Satan by name in the account of the temptation in the garden, it just says serpent, the confession is right to place him there. The devil, the Apostle John tells us, was sinning from the beginning and was involved in the murder of Abel. So Cain was of the evil one and slew his brother. He also says in the Revelation that the devil was that ancient serpent. So the devil is that ancient serpent. Placing the biblical data together, including the incident with the bronze serpent, we may conjecture that before he fell, the devil was one of the seraphim, a heavenly winged serpent, a great dragon, heavenly reptile. We also have that reference in Romans to Genesis 3:15, where God promises the seed of the woman is going to crush the head of the seed of the serpent. And Paul says in Romans that the God of peace will soon crush Satan beneath your feet. So if you put all these scriptures together, Satan was very plainly the serpent in Genesis 3, and that's why I take him to be a fallen seraph. Just in passing, where in the incident with the bronze serpent that's lifted up on a pole, the people were being afflicted by snake bites. There were serpents biting them, and whenever they looked on the bronze serpent, they were healed. And the Hebrew, one of the words that's used for the serpent that was lifted up on the pole is seraph, which is related to the word for shining or bright. So the seraphim were heavenly dragons, and I believe that Satan was one of them and fell. So be that as it may, he seduced our first parents into an eating of the forbidden fruit, which corresponded to the lust of the flesh, the lust of the eyes, and the pride of life. That phrase is taken from 1 John, love not the world or the things in the world, the lust of the flesh, the lust of the eyes, and the pride of life. But notice how those match up with the temptation in Genesis. The fruit that Eve looked on was good to eat. It was pleasant to look on, and it would make one wise. Good to eat, lust of the flesh, pleasant to look on, lust of the eyes, able to make one wise, pride of life. God permitted this to happen, having a more glorious result and end in mind than would have been achieved had he prevented the sin. The glorious end, the glorious intent, the glorious purpose was his own glory. Two of the most glorious attributes of God, justice and mercy, would have gone unrevealed in a world without sin. So God was pleased to manifest for his own glory the greatness of his justice and the greatness of his mercy. And in order to be able to do that, sin needed to occur. There needed to be sinners to forgive, and there needed to be sinners to judge. Paragraph 2. By this sin, they fell from their original righteousness and communion with God, and so became dead in sin, and wholly defiled in all the parts and faculties of soul and body. Because of their sin, Adam and Eve fell from their original state of righteousness and fellowship with God. The end result of their sin was just what God had promised. The day you eat of the fruit of the tree in the middle of the garden, you shall surely die. And so the human race came to live in death. Living in death might seem like an odd phrase, but Paul speaks that way in Ephesians 2. You were dead in your trespasses and sins, in which you used to walk So you're walking around in a condition of death. Some Christians call this state total depravity, but this is misleading because it sounds like absolute depravity. Think of total depravity the right way in this way. Absolute depravity would be like a glass of ink. Total depravity is like a glass of water with a cup with a thimble full of ink dumped in it. So the water is there, but the ink gets into everything. There's no part of the water that's unaffected by the ink. So it's not ink completely, but it is totally affected. So total depravity should actually be thought of as a total inability, because sin gets into everything. Every part of man is fallen. Every part of man is affected by the ink. So the fallen state of man is not total depravity as in absolute depravity, as in as bad as it's possible to be, or human beings are just as bad as a demon out of hell. That's not what depravity means. Depravity means that we are broken and fallen in every aspect of our being, our intellectual life, our physical life, our emotional life, our spiritual life. Everything is busted. So the meaning of this doctrine, total depravity, is not that men are infinitely wicked, but rather that men are actually dead. We consequently have total inability with regard to saving ourselves or preparing ourselves to be saved. Total inability, we can't save ourselves, and we can't get ourselves assembled into such a condition where we are savable. We don't make ourselves savable, and we don't save ourselves. Every aspect of man is fallen, wholly defiled in all the parts and faculties of the soul and body. In other words, there's no place within a man where that man could stand in order to get a grip on himself, to pull himself out of sin. The phrase wholly defiled in all captures the sense of this doctrine. Men cannot save themselves, and men cannot prepare themselves to be saved. Men can only contribute the condition of needing to be saved. All right, paragraph 3. They, being the root of all mankind, the guilt of this sin was imputed. And the same death in sin and corrupted nature conveyed to all their posterity descending from them by ordinary generation. So the first Adam bestows the same kind of things which the second Adam does. Here we see what falls in those categories corresponding to justification and sanctification. The second Adam is our justification. The second Adam is our sanctification. Well, the guilt of the first Adam was reckoned to the entire race. That corresponds to justification. In other words, we have had the unrighteousness of his disobedience imputed to us. At the same time, we also have inherited, in a most practical way, the fact of death and the corruption of our nature. This is passed on to everyone who is descended from Adam and Eve. So we are formally, judicially condemned because of the imputation of Adam's sin to us. That's the equivalent of justification, only on the negative side. And we are actually corrupt. We actually commit sins, which would be the opposing counterpart to sanctification, the reverse of sanctification. We have had sin imputed to us, and we progress in sin, just as in the second Adam, we have had righteousness imputed to us, and we progress in righteousness. Paragraph 4. From this original corruption, whereby we are utterly indisposed, disabled, and made opposite to all good, and wholly inclined to all evil, do proceed all actual transgressions. So, from the nature of the tree proceeds the nature of the fruit. The fruit is determined by the nature of the tree. Because we have inherited this corruption of nature from Adam, our actions are naturally corrupt. Taking this in natural order, the first problem is what we are in Adam, the second problem is what I am because of Adam, and the third problem is what I do. All right, so go over that again. The first problem is what we are in Adam, the second problem is what I am because of Adam, and the third problem is what I do. Paragraph 5. The corruption of nature during this life doth remain in those that are regenerated. And although it be, through Christ, pardoned and mortified, yet both of itself and all the motions thereof are truly and properly sin. The reason Christians continue to struggle with sin within themselves is because this corruption of nature remains even in those who are converted. Our prior condition was one of reigning sin. The condition of believers now is that of subdued, albeit remaining, sin. So before someone's converted, it's reigning sin. Now it's remaining sin. By nature, the believer still retains his Adamic corruptions. However, because of the new creation in Christ, those sins and inclinations are both pardoned and mortified. Moreover, they remain in with us, and they remain sin and sinful. The false ideal of sinless perfection in this life is consequently a lie. Those who believe in sinless perfection in this life should practice what they profess, and that would require abandoning this particular lie. Of course, I recall a story that Spurgeon tells. He once encountered a young man who claimed to have arrived at sinless perfection, and he had arrived. He'd made it. He was now wholly without fault or blame. And instead of arguing with him, Spurgeon says that he leaned forward and trod heavily on his foot, and he said his perfection vanished like the morning dew. All right, paragraph 6. Every sin, being both original and actual, being a transgression of the righteous law of God, and contrary thereunto, doth in its own nature bring guilt upon the sinner, whereby he is bound over to the wrath of God and curse of the law, and so made subject to death with all miseries spiritual, temporal, and eternal. So then, we are condemned and guilty not only for what we do, but also for what we are. The sin imputed to us is ours, and the sin we commit is ours. Sin is defined by the law of God, and not by what our nature enables us to perform or to avoid. Because we are thus constituted sinners, we are under the wrath of God and the curse of the law. The result of this for us is death and all misery. The miseries which come upon us are spiritual, temporal, and eternal. This is hard. Very few preachers of the gospel preach a hard line on sin anymore. And those rare exceptions who preach on sin preach about sins that people commit, sins that they do. Very, very few people preach on the sinfulness, the sin that we are, because people have this illusion that they could quit doing certain things. Oh, if I just gritted my teeth, or if I just made a new resolution, if I just buckled down, I could get rid of that bad habit. But nobody can change what they are. I think I could change what I do, which is not quite accurate, but I think I can. But nobody can change what they are. Nobody can reinvent themselves, however much they want to try.
New St. Andrew's College thanks you for listening.